Alles klar. Hello, welcome to my presentation entitled Development or Developing Harmonized CIA Standards. Oh, where's my here? My name is Fukami. I work for the a little company on Malta called Crab Nebula as head of Brussels office, and I'm primarily task and focused on the CRA, like standardization, in particular as part of what's called the ETSI STF 701, that is a special task force to develop standards in a different way than they used to. I'm also at first as a liaison and co-chair of the AI Security Special Interest Group and the newly founded Time Security SIG that is primarily dealing with the 2038 bug. In the pa past, I've worked as an offensive security and had a bunch of advisor and blue team jobs. But most of why I'm so attached to EU policy and also kind of a little bit obsessed with it comes from the past, I would say, two decades of digital rights advocacy and the learnings that I took in that whole process and how Brussels work and how to include stakeholders and get them up on speed on these type of issues. So the talk is about the standardization, but in order to understand a little bit better why that is needed and what is happening there, I start with what is called the NLF, the new legislative framework that builds the base of it. Then some CRA basics, and then the primary part of the talk that is what is happening in that regard and why it matters. The new legislative framework is a framework that was developed in the mid-80s or started in the mid-80s because beforehand, before mid 85, the way how you put products on the market in the EU was rather complicated because you had to, as a manufacturer or someone who wanted to distribute goods in the EU, you had to go through every single member state in order to ask them how to put stuff on the market. And at one point, they said, okay, we want to have a single market. We want to have that economic actors have it easier to operate within the EU. And so the new approach came and it has had several iterations. And since the mid-2000s, it grow into what's called the new legislative framework. The mentioned new approach principles that were already developed in the mid-80s is the idea that the harmonization for EU-wide placing of goods should be limited to the essential requirements and not to every aspect that a product has. And all of it is prime, like most of it is pre-market. That means the things that manufacturers have to do in order to comply to the market has to be done before they put it on a market. I come a little bit later back to it. The role of standards is that you do not have to use them. They are voluntary, but what they give you as a manufacturer, when you use especially harmonized standards, they give you what's called a presumption of conformity. And that is something very special that is different to what, for example, an ISO standard provides or the classical standards from engineers like IEEE, IETF, and so on. That is what I meant. So the simple formula is that you have the essential requirements of the product that is laid out in the law, so in the product regulation for a particular product. Then you have the standards that are developed by the European standardization organizations, but again, they are voluntary. Then there are a bunch of what's called assessment modules that allow you as a manufacturer or that is a frame how you have to assess the conformity of your product. Then you draw up the declaration, you can put your CE mark, and then you can place your product on the market. So that is basically what that is. What the manufacturer also have to provide besides the declaration of conformity, that is a technical documentation, that is a risk assessment and traceability information for the physical and software supply chain. I mentioned the modules A to H. This comes from the new legacy framework, so from the Blue Guide. That is an overview over all of the possible modules and how they relate to each other. So you see, you have a design phase and you have the production phase that cover different aspects of it. The way how they are differentiated is on one hand based on what is the English term? The German term is Baumusterprüfung, but the English term the idea refers to that you have internal controls as a manufacturer, and then you have an external entity that looks at it and says, okay, that's in conformance with the regulation. There's also an aspect of quality assurance. Again, we come back to it later when we talk about what the CRA has. So the core of the talk that the rest is going to have, you can basically summarize it under CE for software, although it goes far beyond just software. And what we are looking at primarily are the three things in blue. That is the regulation itself. It is a standardization request, and that is the technical descriptions that describe every category that is in the law and in the implementing acts to make sure that manufacturers understand what they have to do and how they have to do it. Everything that I talk, or most of what I talk here, can be found in what's called the Blue Guide that was updated 2022 for the last time, but especially for the CRA, since it contains so many software aspects, it's going to be updated anytime soon, or in the next 2-3 years, which is great. So let's talk a little bit about the Cyber Resilience Act. So unlike what many people think, the Cyber Resilience Act is not a manufacturer regulation nor a security regulation. It is a market access legislation. That means in order to put a product on the market, if it has digital elements, it has to, you have to have the procedures before you put that on the market, like for every other product. The difference is that you have to fulfill or that you have to show how you deal with the essential requirements of said law. And that is for the whole life cycle. And it is not just the requirements for cybersecurity in general, that's also for everything that deals or that has to do with the handling of vulnerabilities. The scope, it is scoped in a way that it covers a lot of the categories of products that you can think about, but however, at the end, it still is only, I would say, 80%, because they very, very many digital products fall into either several categories, or they are not categorized because there's pure software, or they are not on the market itself, so are not properly placed, but still you have that thing due to the supply chain requirements that there are also aspects that play a role in drawing up the conformance. And what's also special here is that you have what's called remote data processing, and that refers to, so it's, the difference is a service doesn't fall under the CRA. A website, for example, is not required to show conformity to the CRA, but if you have, let's say, an app on a mobile phone and it interacts with a service, that part of it is the remote data processing, if it is necessary for the for the application or for the product to function. The CMA distinguishes between a couple of different types of products. There are the so-called important products. They are divided into class one, class two. You can think about it as they perform critical functions for other products in the class one, and the class two are those who significantly or have the potential to significantly disrupt or damage other users, other products, infrastructure, and so on. The other group are the critical products. They are the products that potentially require a different process than the normal CE marking. That means it goes to a certification that is very close to CC. The European version of it calls EU CC, and it is like lined out in the Cyber Security Act in great detail. And in the moment, there is a process to align the CRA and the Cyber Security Act so that you can use the certification easily to show that you are or that your product conforms to the CRA as well. The requirements are laid out in, beside the articles in the annex of the CRA, and especially in part one and two. Part one lists the essential requirements, and part two, sorry, I'm very confused. So the parts that are essential for the conformity are all laid out in Annex 1 and 2 for the requirements of the manufacturer, and you have to comply to everything that is in Annex 1. That contains the listed essential requirements. And when you look at it, it is not necessarily something super crazy. That is what, when you are in development, that is pretty much what you would tell everybody how to produce safe software and safe products. However, there are a bunch of things here that are heavily dependent from the product that you actually put on the market, because some things just do not have access control, or they do not have personal data or other things. So it is really all about that the essential requirements and how they apply to your product as a manufacturer. The other part is what you have for the vulnerability management. That means on one hand, you have to provide when you find vulnerability that is, or when you are aware of a vulnerability that is publicly exploited, then you have to report that to what's called the single reporting platform. It's called single reporting because it does not only allows for the reporting of vulnerabilities, it also allows for the reporting of incidents and voluntary reporting. So that is something where they hope a little bit that the open source community, for example, or security researchers use that to report things that they find that might not be exploited at the moment of the reporting. But the major thing that you have to do, I said that CE is all about pre-market. So what you have to provide as a manufacturer is a CVD. Puts the burdens on manufacturers, not on people producing open source, which is not put on the market as a product. There is a lot depth to it. The question of what is commercial activities in that context, and so on. However, the newly introduced actor called open source software steward is kind of an interesting role in terms of it looks a little bit like a manufacturer from the outside, maybe, but it's basically the idea that you have an entity that cares about the support and the development of post components or apps or services and code. And the obligations contain things like, as well as CVD policies, or that people know how to contact the steward or like the projects if someone finds vulnerabilities. Another thing is that they have to cooperate, or that they are meant to cooperate with the market surveillance authority at the request of them. But of course, the market surveillance authorities, as I have got to know them, they are also open for questions from this type of actor when there are problems. There's also an aspect in Article 25 that is security attestations. It is not entirely clear what that is really going to be in the end. So let's see, the discussions just started. But what is most interesting is, even if a steward does not comply, there is no way how anyone can impose any type of penalty. The only kind of thing that a market surveillance authority could do is to say, oh, you declare yourself a steward, but in reality, you are a manufacturer. So that they put such an actor into a different category. But that's about it. A couple of other notes when it comes to CIA compliance. So the compliance with the CRA is enough for the market access. What that means is no member state can say, oh, in order to be compliant with the CRA, you also have to show this and this and this. That does not mean that a country like Germany, for example, can say, oh, we want to have for our systems where we buy software products, whatever, they might have extra like things that they want to have implemented. But for the pure CRA compliance, you do not have to show more than exactly what the CRA requires from you. And this is because the CRA is a regulation and not a directive that would allow the member states to have way more like flexibility in order to implement these type of rules. I showed the many different ways how the NLF allows to do conformity assessment or like what modules are used. For the CRA, it basically boils down to three module combinations and the EUCC. So that means module H, which is self-assessment, basically, that the manufacturer can say, oh, okay, I look at what I do, I write it down in my conformity, do my documentation, do my CVD policy document, and that's pretty much it. Then there is a combination of two modules, B and C, that means that on one hand, there is a third-party assessment, and on the other hand, an internal product, like process. So that is like what you have seen in like design and production, that is a little bit into that direction, that you say, okay, for the basic part, you do the like internal stuff, and then you let it like check from another entity. And the third actual module that you can use is full quality assurance. That means that you do not aim at conformity for a single product, but for your process producing products. So the idea here is that you say, I have a process that allows me to produce my products or product lines that I have in always the same type of quality and with always the same features. So yeah, that might also go through a third party assessment in order to look if you actually do that correctly. And then, as already mentioned, the cyber security scheme, where that works, and it is like in the moment, the aim is to have that for critical products. I just move forward because I actually said that. The interesting thing here is to have that in one go, because it also shows one of the exceptions. So when you use open source and it is an actual product, normally important one or two need to use harmonized standards or common specifications or cybersecurity or the UCC schemes. But if you use open source, or if it's an open source product up to important class two, it can still do self-assessment. And that is an interesting choice, and also I think a good choice to do that, because it especially in that region and the part of the product lines that you have, that you see that need to conform, it makes a lot of sense that you have that thing kind of on a different level, because you do have a different, normally a different process in general, how that plays out. Oh, I see there's a mistake. Ha, sorry. so what you should take away from that slide is from important class one, there is potentially the thing where you have to go to a third party that helps you with your conformity. The only exception is when you apply a harmonized standard as a class one, then you still can do self-assessment and then draw up your stuff so that reduces the need to go to a third party. So we have already already mentioned harmonized standards a couple of times. The biggest difference between the normal standards and harmonized standards is who does them, and the three organizations who are supposed to do that are Etsy and Zendelec. The way how that works then is that the standards get developed. Or that I should actually put it a little bit different. So when you look at what the core legislation does, so they discuss, you know, like what the ideas of law are, what the enforcement mechanisms are, and so on. And then they have an agreement that gets published, and then you have an implementation phase. And that implementation phase, what it basically does is it is a handover of from the legislative part into the hands of the private actors, because what the standards really do is it is give the manufacturers a possibility to say, okay, we want to apply comply to the requirements of the CRA in that and that form, and the harmonization is that the European Commission says, okay, you can do that. We agree that this is actually addressing all of the things that we have laid out in the CRA itself and in the standardization request, explaining what the Commission aims at to have these standards harmonized and giving them the presumption of conformity. So that is an interesting process, because the Commission, especially because it's a very, very short time frame to get that done. So there is a very close discussion with them around how that actually works. And they very early say, oh, you cannot do this because it is not going to be harmonized, and so on. Then we have that thing. There are two different types of standards. The one part is all about like the horizontal standards which apply to all of the products, and then you have on the other hand the vertical standards that apply to the exact category of products that is specifically laid down in the CRA and the implementing acts describing these type of categories. I go into that a little bit later. I also skipped this because we are not even up to the slides. To give you an idea, what you see here is a timeline of the whole CRA as laid out in the CRA itself. So what you see here is the start of the discussion, or like the proposal that the CRA or the commission put out, and then there is a co-legislative process, and it ends with the, you know, like the gray area is all of the co-legislative part. The green, green and red part is the implementation, and the blue part is the full application, the review and the evaluation of the CRA. So the green part is, this is already, that already passed since the time of the publication. The red part is the development, and this is the time that we have in order to get that done. And the rest is the time that the manufacturers have to implement these standards for their product. I would pause it for a moment and ask if there's any question. If not, we can also just continue, okay? So standardization in practice. I already mentioned there are the three European standardization organizations, Zenelec, and ETSI. The biggest difference between both is that ETSI is membership driven. That means if you become a member, you can access all of the documents and you can participate in all of the meetings without the need to ask anybody, you just join. For Zenelec, that works a lot different. The problem is that, or the way how that works is you become member of your national standardization body. That national standardization body sends you as a delegate into a work group of Zenelec. And you basically have access to the documents of that work group, or maybe of that TC, depending on what the delegation is there, but that's it. The other big difference is that ETSI standards, while under development, you cannot access them, but when they are done, they are free for use. They might contain IPR from someone, but it is explained in the standard what the IPR is. And but it is like free to download and free to use, while the standards from Zenelec are pretty much what you know from the ISO world. That means most of the standards need to be bought by the national standardization body. That is their business model. So the difference is like that ETSI membership is direct membership. You pay for your membership. You are a member. You have these opportunities. For Zenelec, most of what the money comes from is people pay for standards. And in order to build these standards get the expert to really like focus on that in such a small amount of time, there are a bunch of projects that deal with it. So one of them is Stand4CR. That is also a part that where I got my money, get my money from. It is funded by the EU and EFTA, and that is there are two different parts: Stand4CR1 and Stand4CR2. Or the one doesn't have the one, but it is like it was the first one that was primarily for Zenelec rapporteurs, while Stand4CR2 is basically the ETSI rapporteurs. And you see that they are like around 25 people altogether. And as mentioned in the beginning, Etsy established like the specialist task force 701. The website mentioned there shows actually an overview over all of the standards that are going to be developed. And over time, and especially in the next couple of weeks, you will see that filling up with actual drafts. The other thing is CyberStand, that is a funding for individual experts on certain aspects. That is not super great. Let's put it like this, it's like that you cannot get rich from it. But the interesting thing here is that the process itself is interesting. The way how that works and what the deliverables are is very interesting. And but besides the pure development of the standard, they also support, in particular, certain projects to help SMEs and open source projects to help facilitate everything that is in the CRA. Also, the website cyberstand.eu, it's very worth looking at it. Also, you have another week to submit. When you have an idea, when you have something that you think is missing, when you're an expert in a certain field, and especially when you come from an open source or SME background, then just look at it. Maybe you have a good idea, and the experts are really, really needed. I already mentioned that the horizontal standards are Zendelec. The work group that is developing it is in the Joint Technical Committee 13, work group 9. And the idea here is that you have the standards that everybody has to abide to have them in, like, you know, developed in a coherent fashion. The problem is that it takes so long that the horizontal standards might not be ready before the vertical standards, which is a bit of an issue. And the original parts that only contained like kind of the frameworks or something, how the vertical standards kind of align to the whole structure, was one. The second thing was principles of cyber resilience and the vulnerability handling. But in the meantime, they got to other items. One of them is the threat and security objectives and vocabulary that will also be issued as a standard. The vertical standards, they are split across Zendelec and Etsy. The Zendelec standards, they are primarily in three of their technical committees. It's 47X for everything that is like microprocessors, microcontrollers, and special like hardware platforms. 64X is machinery related. That means you have an overlap with Etsy standards, but these standards are all like more OT than IT. And last but not least, 224, that is everything that is tied to like identity technology, like access readers, hardware devices, and so on. The work at Zen is, at least for the work group 9, is at OSD. With OSD, which is like an actually very convenient way of working on standards. It's a lot better than what usually is done, which is sending Word documents. So that is a great way of doing this at Zen. For Etsy, it is a little bit different. You still have, on one hand, some members that say, oh, we want to have still Word documents, but most of the people in the SCF 701 use basically GitLab. And the Etsy GitLab for the internal development called Forge. So we basically write our standard in Markdown. Since we already started, like Etsy has like kind of two avenues. One thing is most of the items are in TC Cyber EUSR, but there are also cooperations between some other technical committees of Etsy, Set and Easy. They cooperate with the technical committees of Zen and Zenelec. But the most, yeah, like kind of, yeah, like items that need permanent discussion and which is basically the standards task force is what you see here. I marked my item because I am the rapporteur for boot managers. And you see that it's like it covers a lot of products, but they are a little bit, you know, like a bit stretch and so on. And you have, for example, the number 42 at the end. That is something that is a little bit different than the others. That is what we call broad verticals. The problem with these type of things is that when you, for example, have a device that has several functionalities, let's say it does antivirus, or a router or whatever that might do an internet connection, or only like something internal, or provides you with a VPN or whatever. So very often these products have several things that are listed in these standards or in the description of the commission. And so the broad verticals, the idea of broad verticals is to say, okay, like we describe a certain group of products that are kind of listed in the COA, but not well covered in terms of the use cases are more tied to what the market really needs rather than generic categories. And especially in the telecommunications field, and Etsy is a telecommunications standardization organization, that is a natural way how they build their broad verticals. The machinery people also do that, and let's see how that all plays out, because the commission says, oh, you can try, but it has to be specific enough for the presumption of conformity. Now we dive a little bit deeper into boot managers, just as an example how these type of things are actually done. So there is the technical description that the commission issued and also has a consultation process around it, and this is a current version of it for boot managers. These things change not super much anymore, but in the moment there is still like a little bit of discussion also with that particular item, because it mentions the operating system, but at the end it is not so much operating systems when you look from the actual technical perspective. It's just boot targets that is not necessarily an operating system. So there is a version 002, so still a very early draft. The scope, I rescoped a little bit, because there is a moment in the beginning where it's not entirely clear where you start. Like you have the initialization that might involve already an operating system, for example, UEFI implementation. So the question here is, what is the exact point that we cover, and the question how to cover it? So I started very, very basic with like a functional architecture. That means that is all about how that process actually verifies the next load or execution of the part of the boot chain. That means has basically no verification really. Verified means that it can, with or without a piece of hardware, for trust to actually check the next stage or the next loaded component. And measured is the way, like this is the first part that really needs a TPM in order to do its security function. Then we have like a bunch of boundaries that we have to look at the standard. That is like, but I already mentioned the hardware, but also like the storage or network where you will get your image or configuration from, the operating system as the layer that can provide the boot manager with updates, and of course physical access, which is in terms of security for boot manager probably the most important one. Then we have like, of course, a boot manager in every piece of hardware in one form or another, and so we have a gazillion use cases for it. And in the moment, we are trying to put that together in a way that makes a bit more sense. What we also looked at is what the boot specific threats are, but it is in development. They are only, like as I said, it's very basic. It's very like it's the beginning of that process. And what I kind of copied from the people doing routers and switches is the way how to do security profiles. The idea here is to say you have a capability, and when you have a capability, you have to fulfill all of the requirements for the capability. So if you have a boot manager that does netboot, it triggers all of the netboot related requirements that you have to fulfill apart from the things that are in the CRA anyways. The challenges that I faced in that context was all about boot managers are not necessarily put on the market as such. You have a lot of integration, so people use open source components like CoreBoot or U-Boot and then build their product using these components. But boot managers are very rarely put on the market as a product. So that does exist, but there are only very, very few companies that would even consider the standard as useful. Let's say, for example, Insight in the US or in China that provides boot managers for example, Dell. They will very likely not use a harmonized European standard in order to do this, because there is no use for them. They have to provide at the end a top level product where that is just a component. The biggest problem that I see is to get that standard fit for purpose, or like very many of these standards fit for purpose, because of the short amount of time. Good standards need a lot of discussion, they need a lot of time, they need people, you know, like discussing what is going on there, and that is just too short to make that proper. However, we need to start from somewhere, and it's better than having nothing. Since I only have 5 minutes, I would go to the last part already here. So the interesting part for everybody who wants to engage now over the next couple of weeks, there will be workshops on how the current state is for particular standards, or the standards that I mentioned here. For Etsy, that is going to be on Etsy Labs. It's basically another GitLab instance where you can either open tickets as a comment, or send your patch. For me, that means that I still have to get some stuff done to get it to a state where I can do that on that platform, because there are certain rules on what it needs to provide. And what is still a little bit of a problem, but it is not just for the boot managers, also for operating systems, that is the whole thing about how do you do proper risk assessment in CIA context for this type of technology, where you as a manufacturer might have no idea where that technology ends up, or your piece of code, or your component. Still, that needs to be in the standard, because it is required for the harmonization. Other than that, I think this is the last one. Yes. Are there any questions? So did that work for you? Did you learn anything?
I might have a question. You
Yes.
mentioned earlier in the standards that the aspect of SME is small and medium enterprises. So if I'm thinking of maybe a self-employed person that has a product with just one or two customers, do they also have to do all of the steps for the self-certification?
That is an excellent question. So the question is here, is that a product? From my understanding, there are a lot of corner cases where what people do is a service or an integration and not putting a product on the market. And that is a huge difference. But the question here is also when your customers require something like a CE mark or a conformance declaration, that might change. So that means like it is very much also market driven. And this is a little bit hard to predict. Like with a lot of EU regulations that try to have carve outs for SMEs, in reality, it might just not work. So a good example is DORA. So DORA says, or like the certification package on DORA says, oh, the SMEs do not need to have the corporate due diligence and reporting duties. But their customers may have, because they are banks, they still have to provide the info. So that means when you as an SME are not able to provide that, that entity might just not do business with you. So this is like where the reality might be a lot more complex than the regulator has, you know, like anticipated. But from the pure, like, you know, from the pure regulation, it's really a matter of, is it the product? Is it the service? You know, does that need to be CE marked? And from what you told me, it sounds as if it's not a product.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we are also done. I'm on time. Yeah. Thank you very much. And I hope you have fun at the MCD. And I'm really, really sad that I cannot join. But yeah. Bye-bye.